The climate is changing. Oceans are warming. Extreme weather is more common. Threatened species are under strain. Whether we accept it or not, it's happening. What we might do about it is up to us. We're on borrowed time.
I'm Andrew Murphy from the Mill Valley Public Library, recording on behalf of the Borrowed Time series. For the second episode of the series, I interviewed Derek Jensen about some themes from his book, Endgame. Today, I'm again interviewing Derek Jensen for what I hope will become a mini-series of sorts, and today we'll be discussing salmon. Derek, thanks for joining.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Although the topic of this interview is salmon, my first question is about people. I'd like to know if you believe if humans, as a species, have a purpose in life.
I think that every species has a purpose in life, and that purpose in life is to improve your habitat on its own terms, to make your habitat healthier, more vibrant, more resilient, and this is how the world became so wild and fecund and full of life in the first place, was by everybody living and dying. And I mean, there's this notion in capitalism and in the whole Western society, really, that we need to exploit as best we can, exploit as fast as we can, as much as we can, and that evolution belongs to the most selfish, you know, the selfish gene theory, the notion that those who exploit the best, the most capitalist, are the ones who win. And well, that's true in the short term. It's not how life works. And I mean, again, how do they think that life got to be so extraordinarily rich in the first place? It's because everybody made the world a better place by their life and death. And you know, salmon make the world a better place by their life and death. They make the forests a better place. They forests grow much, much faster. Salmon-dependent forests grow much faster with the salmon running up than when they don't run up, and remarkably faster. And that's the role of everybody, is to make the world a better place, and we unfortunately have forgotten.
In our last interview, there was a question that I didn't get to ask you, and you kind of already, in a way, answered it. But I had hoped to ask a quote from Endgame, and you said the only way to survive in the long run is to give back more than you can take. And my question at the time was, how do we do this? But I guess you just answered it by...
Well, I think that, it depends on the species, that for salmon... I mean, one of the things they do is they carry tremendous amounts of nutrients from the ocean up into the forest, and then they leave them in their bodies, and they leave their nutrients for the trees and for the eagles and for the bears and for the next generation of salmon. It's, I don't know what it is, 50% or 60% or 40% or something of the food eaten by baby salmon is the dead salmon from the year before, and I mean that feeds everybody. So that's one way salmon help. And so one way bears help maintain a forest is by eating the salmon and then pooping them somewhere else, carrying the nutrients around. And there's a parasite, I can't remember what the name of the parasite is, but it's pretty cool. I read this 15 years ago. There's a parasite who the life cycle is that it's eaten by a fish, and then the fish, it causes the fish to change its behavior and swim to the surface of the water and flash its belly. And then seabirds will eat the fish, and then the parasite will go through the seabirds. Doesn't do anything to seabirds. And then the seabirds poop it out. And then I think it has another host that's a clam or a crab or something. I think there's a third one, and it lives in that for a while, and then it goes to the fish again. And the interesting thing is it ends up that if you get rid of this parasite, the entire community collapses, because the seabirds have too hard of a time catching fish if the fish aren't basically acting suicidally. So it's bad news. The important thing to remember is, I love this line by Paul Stamets, that nature loves a community. And I'm going to ask you a personal question. How old are you?
39.
Okay, so you're still on the side where nature loves you. But I'm 59, and it's becoming increasingly clear over the past 15 years that once you're past child-rearing age, nature doesn't care. You know, my body's falling apart. And I was just talking to a friend last night who was saying the exact same thing. She's in her late 40s, and her body's falling apart. Or, you know, why did I bring that up? Oh, because nature really loves the larger community. The important thing is not how well I do. The important thing is not how well this one particular frog does. I mean, for crying out loud, most frog babies die. It's like 1% make it to adulthood. Or I was going to talk about another creature and how they help their surroundings. That I did this interview with this guy who loves sea turtles, and sea turtles are just extraordinary. And sea turtles have a very similar role to salmon in that they gather food all through the ocean, and then they bring it up and they lay it in eggs on the beach. And a lot of creatures will time their own reproduction for when the turtles come in and lay the eggs, that because there's a feast of eggs that they can eat, and then when the babies hatch, they go swimming out to the ocean, and there are just lines of fish out there waiting to eat these little snacks. And I mean, that's sad for those individual sea turtles, but that's, you know, life feeds off life. And what they're doing is, it's effectively, if you think about nutrient transfer, it's tremendous transfer of nutrients from all over the ocean up to the shoreline communities. And then I want to mention one more. I was having this conversation with a friend of mine. Something, I live in bear territory, and I see bears, multiple bears every day. And one thing that bears do quite often is they kill trees, and they'll kill little trees. It's pretty interesting that a male, when he shows off in the spring, if a male's hanging out around a female to show off how strong he is, it's kind of like the old cliche of, you know, the teenage boy walking down the beach and he sees a girl that he's interested in, and so he puffs out his chest. It's the same sort of deal. What they'll do is they'll stand on their hind legs, and they'll reach up and they'll grab a Doug fir, maybe a, I don't know, 20, 30 foot tall Doug fir with their paws, and then they bend down and pull down with their paws, and they'll break the tree. And then they love to eat Doug fir, the inner bark, and sometimes they'll girdle a tree. Sometimes they just eat some of it. That's fine. Sometimes they girdle a tree, in which case the tree dies. And so I was asking a friend of mine who's a wildlife biologist, so how does that serve the larger community? And he said, I don't know. I've never studied it, but here's something that comes to mind. Where he lives is a mixed tan oak Doug fir forest. And Doug firs grow faster. They reproduce earlier. They have basically every competitive advantage over the tan oak, except the bears don't like to eat the tan oak bark. So in this case, the bears are maintaining a tan oak tan oak Doug fir mixed forest by killing some of the Doug firs. And so this is, I mean, there are so many ways that a different species can serve the community, serve the larger biotic community. And I think one of the most important questions, which I hope you don't ask me because I don't have an answer for this really, but one of the most important questions we can ask is, you know, what is the human role in a healthy, functioning, natural community? And that, of course, is going to depend on where you live, because the human role is going to be different in a desert than it is in a shoreline area, than it is in a then it is in a rainforest area. It's going to be different no matter where they are, but depending on the natural community. But we could probably, if we really tried, we could come up with some commonalities, just like, you know, bears, I think, will probably play similar roles no matter the community. They're an in some places they're an apex predator, in some places they're not. Like grizzly bears are more than black bears. But anyway, so that's, I think, a hugely important question for us to ask. I think that a lot of scientists have it wrong in that, and we've been taught it wrong by the whole, you know, selfish gene idea, and that's, it's not just Richard Dawkins' fault. This has been pushed for a long time. But they, instead of asking what is the niche we can exploit, the question to ask is, what is the role we can fill in this natural community, and what role do we fill that makes the natural community better on its own terms?
Well, perhaps,
and I hope you don't ask me. If you can ask me, it's just I'm going to stammer around, because it's, you know, our relationship with the natural world is so messed up that we end up stammering and thinking about it a long time, which we should, instead of having been told this, you know, having been passed a, you know, the Talawa lived where I live now for at least 12,500 years, and they did so without destroying the place. So I'm guessing that if we were able to talk to Talawa people who still understood the way that they had lived here for 12,000 years, they would probably be able to give us some hints as to the role that the Talawa played in helping to serve the larger community.
Well, I'll ask a much more simple question then.
Great.
I know that you have an appreciation for, as you put it, the full community of nature. But what about salmon in particular excites you? Because I know that you do love salmon in particular.
Well, it's interesting. And I'm going to give you the really boring answer first, and then we can get to some better answers. The really boring answer is because they're here, and they're one of the most crucial species to this region. And if I love the forest, and I grew up in Colorado, and I guess I didn't realize how very much I loved trees until I left the Great Plains State. And now whenever I go back to Colorado, it's like, wow, there aren't any trees here, are there? But if I lived in Colorado, I would probably love prairie dogs just as much as I love salmon. And if I lived in, I'm trying to think of, I mean, there are really important species in different places. And if I lived in, and maybe if I lived in, I'm just making this up, Alabama or Florida, maybe I would love alligators. I don't know. So some of it is they're really important to the region, and the region is important to me, which means that they are really important to me. That's one part. And another part is, you know, we haven't gotten to the creature yet, but we'll get there in a second. But it's, they were uncountable. There were so many. And I mean, it's a measure of this culture's destructiveness that, you know, they were able to, in less than 100 years, this culture has pretty much wiped out the salmon on the Columbia. I mean, they're completely devastated. And they started getting devastated maybe 120 years ago or 115 years ago or whenever, when they started putting in the canning factories. And then, of course, the dams were worse or made it even worse. And so just, you know, even when I was a kid, I remember reading about the passenger pigeons, and there would be flocks so large they darkened the sky for days at a time, flying 60 miles an hour and sounding like rolling thunder. And they were wiped out. And it's just a measure. Or the great auk. There were entire islands that were so full of great auks, A-U-K. That's why there's no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere. The auk filled that ecological role. They filled that ecological purpose. And they there were so many that some explorers said that you could load every ship in France and wouldn't make a dent. And they were wiped out in the late 19th century. Just an example of such incredible fecundity and incredible, I mean, unimaginable. I cannot imagine. Well, I can kind of imagine. So somebody sent me a picture maybe 15 years ago of a river up in Alaska, and they didn't put any explanation. It was just they sent me a little note saying, hey, love your work, here's a picture. And at first I was like, why'd you send me a picture of this river with a brown bottom? I can't. And then I look more closely, and I see that the edge of the river is yellow, and the middle of the river is brown. And then I look more closely still, and I see the reason the middle of the river is brown is because it is literally filled with salmon. You literally can't see the bottom of the river. And I've heard accounts of that. You know, the Klamath is 20 miles south of here, 10 miles south of here or something, and it's it was described by the early European explorers as black and roiling with fish. And I've never seen that. I've never seen a sky darkened with birds. And so there is something about, I mean, it's the same with the prairie dogs, that there was one prairie dog village that went, oh gosh, I'm making up the numbers. It was in Texas. It was like, I don't know, I'm making this up, but 10,000 square miles or 50,000. This was huge. I mean, unimaginably big. It contained more than a billion individuals, I think. And I have seen some cool things. Like just yesterday, I saw four black bears sort of sleeping in a pile. That's pretty cool. But I've never seen that level of just, I keep saying this word, that level of fecundity. And so that's another reason. And also, salmon are just really extraordinary creatures. They've evolved to, you know, swim down or float down the river, and then go into this big ocean and live for however long it is that the different species of salmon lives, and then find their way home through a tremendous sense of smell. And another thing that really moves me about them is that when they have put in dams, the salmon would bash themselves against the dams trying to get home. And that seems like a wonderful and powerful metaphor for how all of us should be, just implacably trying to get home. And those are some of the reasons that I love salmon. And I love lamprey too. You know, I don't talk as much about lamprey, but lamprey are getting hammered just as much. And I've seen some old pictures of lamprey, and they were just as abundant as the salmon. There were, I've seen a picture from like 1905 or 1907 that is this rock that is entirely covered with lampreys. That's the rock is just, there's water flowing over it, and there's so they're not out of the water, but there's this, it's just the entire thing is covered. And I've never myself seen an adult lamprey. I've seen plenty of babies. There's plenty of babies in the stream that's 50 yards from here. And I know that because the bottom is sandy, and I wanted to see if it was spawning habitat that had been covered up with sand from a logging operation, or if it's just sand. And it ends up, it's just right here is really sandy. So I started just, you know, I got in the creek, and I just started, you know, like a dog, just sort of scooping up sand, and then I started seeing all these little itty bitty black worm like things, and so I. You know, I put them back in the water, obviously, and then I came inside and I started looking it up, and I didn't know what it was. So then I just called a wildlife fisheries person. I called the university and said, "Hey, what's this weird thing that I think I found?" And they said, "Oh, it's a baby lamprey." Anyway, I love lamprey as much as salmon, but I just don't talk about them as much. And I'm going to do an interview very soon about grayling, who do sort of the same thing as salmon do in other parts of the country, like up in the Arctic, and they're getting hammered just like salmon.
Well, I also grew up in Colorado, and the prairie dogs are getting hammered there too. I lived in Denver and Boulder, and also in between Denver and Boulder.
I lived in between Denver and Boulder. I grew up just west of Louisville.
Okay, yeah, I lived in Broomfield. I'm
embarrassed.
And where? I kind of said it strangely because I don't like to admit it, but I lived in Broomfield for a couple of years.
Oh yeah, my best friend, or one of my best friends in college, lived in Broomfield. Have you been back? I know this is off topic, but I think this is actually important stuff. Have you been back?
Yes. So I moved there I'm not originally from there, but I moved there as I started high school in 1994. And at that point, Broomfield initially, again, and for the listener's sake, in between Denver and Boulder, there wasn't much there, except for prairie dogs. And to answer your question, I've been back, yes, and it's between Denver and Boulder now is nothing but, you know, strip malls.
And I don't know if I said this last time in the interview, but that's how I started to be an environmentalist, was when I was, I'm older than you, obviously, and in seventh grade, they put in a subdivision right next to where I lived. That'd be 1967 or 68, subdivision right next to where I lived, and it took out all the, there weren't any prairie dogs there, but it took out all the garter snakes and meadowlarks and all the grasses and all the cottonwood trees and replaced them with houses. And I remember thinking as I was a kid, if they keep doing this, where will these others live? And they can't do this forever because they'll run out of space. And the point is, I couldn't articulate this as a kid, but you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. It breaks my heart every time I go to Colorado. I don't go very often because when I was a kid, and this is not going to mean anything to a lot of people, but they can just transpose it to where they lived. You know, Louisville, Lafayette, Longmont, those were all separate communities. And every Valentine's Day, we would drive up to Loveland to mail a Valentine's note to my grandma because we wanted to get the stamp, you know, for this is out of, you know, Valentine's Day from your grandchild from Loveland. And I was in Loveland maybe 6 or 7 years ago. And when I went up there as a kid, it's like you go there and there's the post office. And now it's just strip mall after strip mall after, I mean, it's a big town now. And everybody has this experience of the place where you grew up and then, you know, you can't go back because, you know, I was one of my mom's favorite movies. She died 14 months ago. One of my mom's favorite movies was Trip to Bountiful, which is about this old woman who goes back to her childhood home one last time before she, you know, sort of gives up. And that play was written, I believe, in the 50s. And, man, there's no way you could write that now because she goes back to Bountiful and the town is basically a ghost town and there's the abandoned house. And now if you went back to where you grew up, it would be... It's like I did a talk in Lincoln, Nebraska back in the early 2000s, and my mom grew up in Lincoln in the 30s, and she used to, her grandparents lived across the way and had, you know, a half dozen cows, and they were in the pasture in between. And so when my mom went to visit her grandma, she would climb up on the fence and hop on the back of a cow, and then the cow would walk over. She's like 5 years old. And I went there. I went to where my mom grew up, and there's not a cow within 10 miles. There's not a pasture within 10 miles. It's nothing. There's shopping centers, and, you know, this... Anyway, so we are... Well, I was going to say we're getting away from salmon, but we're not. I wrote a book called Monsters a couple years ago, which is a collection of short stories, and one of the short stories is... One part of one of the short stories is a bird from a bird's perspective who's flying back to where he grew up, and he, you know, migrates south every year and he's migrating back north, but when he gets there to his home, he finds there's nothing there anymore. There's just a house, and there's not all the forest is gone. And you know, we see the same thing with the salmon. That's what takes us back to the salmon on this is, you know, battering their heads against dams because their home has been cut off to them. And I think about this all the time with non-humans. You know, it's like there goes the neighborhood. It's, you know, where they lived, and they can't go back now. And they can't go back not only for the emotional reasons of it being too painful, but they can't go back because there's no habitat left. So I was thinking that this was, that we were getting way too off topic, but I don't think it's off topic at all because this is what salmon face every time they come home.
Yeah, and I almost took us, and maybe I will, off topic, but also not off topic. In the theme of movies in Colorado, I was also thinking of a movie from the late 70s called Over the Edge. I don't know if you know that one.
I don't know it.
Well, it's Matt Dillon's first movie, and it's basically about, it's filmed in Aurora, Colorado. So... Mm-hmm. At that, which is east of Denver for the listener's sake, but it's late 70s at that point. It's not developed. It's just a prairie. And the mountains are in the background. And it's about teenagers basically having nothing to do in suburbia. That's the Hollywood plot. But it reminds me of my experience in Colorado, seeing it now, because it's just fields and mountains and the cities in the background. And now from Aurora to Boulder, it's nothing but development.
Right.
But I'll bring it back to fish and Colorado, because, I mean, I guess going back to my original question of what drew you specifically to salmon, as someone from Colorado, I was curious, like, why salmon as opposed to, say, trout?
Probably because, you know, I moved from Colorado to Nevada, and we will glide over those years because I was very unhappy. I'm not a desert person. I recognize that some people love the desert, and I can fully admire the beauty, but I'm a tree person. And I remember visiting a friend in Nevada. When I lived there, I remember going over to somebody's house for dinner, and he owned like 60 acres, and the guy next to him owned 60 acres. And because there weren't any trees, it's like they can still see into your house. And I just have, again, I respect that open spaces, but it's not me. I'm a forest-dependent creature, I have learned. So anyway, after Nevada, I moved to North Idaho, which was a stunningly beautiful place, but same deal. I went back. I lived there in the 80s, and I went back in the 2005 or so. And, oh, my gosh, all the areas that were just this beautiful forest are now subdivision. Anyway, so I lived in Idaho, and then I moved to Spokane to go to Eastern Washington University in Cheney. And salmon are, of course, really, really important to the inland Northwest, too. And so one of the issues that we worked on basically a few issues. And one of the issues was forests. And one of the issues was, and there were other issues like Selkirk caribou and bull trout and stuff. But the primary issues are either forests or salmon. And so that's where I got really started to get involved with the salmon. So maybe that's another reason I love salmon is because, yeah, I cared about prairie dogs when I was a kid, and I was really sad. Okay, here's another thing. I know that this is going to be just too much inside talk between you and me, but people can extrapolate this elsewhere. You've driven into Boulder, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the Boulder-Denver Turnpike?
Yeah, many, many times.
Okay, so when you're driving to Boulder, and then the road veers right, and then you keep, now you're going north, and off to your left is the University of Colorado, and there's a huge parking lot there. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do, yeah.
And off to the right are a bunch of hotels? Okay, when I was a kid, off to the left was not a parking lot. You know what there was instead? Take a guess. You know what it's going to be?
My guess is prairie.
Yep. Well, no, say the other word. Say the last half. Prairie?
And groundhog? Or prairie dog, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. The huge prairie dog community was right there. And the point is that I was just a kid, and I was really sad when they put in the parking lot, but I wasn't yet an activist, so I wasn't doing anything for the prairie dogs. I was just a kid. And as an adult, salmon were really one of the first. Salmon and forests were the first two things that I really started working to protect. So that's probably another reason I love salmon so much. But had I come of environmental age, with prairie dogs and fighting to protect them, I'm sure I would have loved them just as much.
Well, on the theme of like development and home, I want to ask like a very specific local question for you now. A little bit to the south of you, though, in Humboldt Bay, there's a site that was once a pulp mill that a Norwegian company, Nordic Aquafarms, wants to build a $400 million land-based hatchery. I assume you're familiar with this?
Actually, I'm not, but it's horrifying. Go ahead.
Well, I first became aware of it a few weeks back because their recently hired project director was fired. Basically posted, well, this is, I think it was discovered years ago, or it was discovered recently, but years ago he had killed a lion on his big game hunt, and he posted a photo of it at the time. And some people found it and just kind of posted it and called the company out of, why are you hiring a lion killer to supposedly produce sustainable fish? But I guess like the bigger question is, you know, at this point, I would hope that it's been determined that hatcheries are not good for wild fish, and yet they're still producing brand new, huge multi-million dollar hatcheries. And it just seems in poor form to also have it on a site that was previously a mill there where the redwoods used to be.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what you want me to answer. Do you want me to talk about how hatcheries are harmful, or what direction do you want me to go?
You can go that direction, or yeah, let's keep it to fish this time instead of development.
Okay. Hatcheries are problematical for a bunch of reasons. One of them is they provide the illusion that there are a lot more fish than there are, and people can see some fish like, oh, that's great, there's still salmon, when most of them are not wild. And then the next, there are a bunch of problems. One is that because these hatchery fish are raised basically they're basically hell on earth. The hatchery fish are raised in extremely crowded, factory farms, extremely crowded conditions, which we know are just feedlots for various illnesses, and then a lot of time, and they can transfer these illnesses to wild fish. Also, they are a lot of times they will dump the fish all at once, and they will outcompete the local fish, because if you drop in 1,000 fish that are hatchery in where there were 10 wild fish, the 1,000 hatchery fish are going to eat all the food, and so they can actually outcompete the locals for that. It's very interesting. I wrote a book about zoos many years ago about how horrible zoos are. And before I go any further, I want to say that I am not a purist, in that I don't have a problem as a last-ditch effort for there to be a captive breeding program for reintroduction into the wild. If that's the only thing you can do to save a species, then I am 100% for it. Having said that, they found that if you have animals that are only 2 or 3 generations in captivity, their genetics have already been altered enough that they're, some people don't even hardly consider them the same species. I think that's too far. I mean, obviously they are the same species in terms of being able to interbreed, but there have been changes that have happened so quickly that have made it so they are adapted to captivity as opposed to the wild, that they can cause some genetic harm. And so interbreeding of hatchery and wild fish can be really problematical too, because you'll have multiple generations of fish who have been raised in hatcheries. And then there's also the fact that hatcheries were put in the first place as an excuse for dams. That at one point in Washington State, you were only allowed to build, the only dams for a time that could be built were dams that were, when you're not commensurate, but when you're adjacent to the complement, I guess, or as part of a hatchery. And that's actually how Elwha Dam was built. Elwha Dam was, wink, wink, a dam associated with a hatchery that, what do you know, we can use it for electricity. But the legal excuse they were able to make was that they were building a hatchery, and so they needed the dam to collect the fish. And that's complete legalistic crap. Anyway, those are some of the problems with it. And then there's another thing too, which is they torture the animals when they spawn them. I mean, they don't get to spawn wild. They manually spawn them and gut them. And anyway, so I have a bunch of problems with hatcheries. The main problems are ecological, though, that it doesn't really, their purposes are to support commercial fishing. The purpose is not to help wild fish.
Do you even think there is any true wild fish left?
Yeah. Yeah. There. Why are you asking?
Specifically salmon.
Yeah, why are you asking that about this? Are you saying because they've interbred, or?
Kind of. Not specifically the interbreeding per se, but just the impact the hatcheries have had on wild fish and.
Yep. My understanding. Okay, and I'm making these numbers up. So anybody, if my numbers are wrong, don't send me nasty emails. My understanding is that in places like in California or Oregon, I don't know about the Columbia. My understanding is that, and this is not true for Alaska. I don't know, though. I don't know what it is for Alaska. Anyway, my understanding is that like 2 or 3% of the fish are wild at this point. And I could be off. It could be 20%, but it's not. Most of the fish are not wild, and but there are still wild fish, and
the numbers are interesting because there's different ways to present them, and part of that is because, and I don't know why this is, but when people talk about a specific species of salmon, they might limit it to a region. So they might say the salmon on the Snake River are extinct or near extinct, but not in Alaska, as you just said. And I don't know why they distinguish regionally and why they can say one group is extinct, but another's not.
Because they were genetically distinct, and B, those particular runs can die. And so the coho salmon on the Smith River are going to be distinct from the coho salmon. I don't even know if coho go down to the Sacramento, but the coho salmon on the Klamath even, they'll be, God, what is this? There's a story. Yeah, there are stories as to whether, I might have the details wrong on this, but a friend of mine who's a fisheries biologist was just telling me a story a while back about how there are discussions as to whether coho, I believe it was coho, definitely run in the Smith, and they run in Elk Creek, which is right behind my house, and there are questions as to whether coho used to be in the Klamath. Or it could be the Klamath, they run the Klamath, but they don't know if they used to run the Smith, one or the other. And so there are big discussions going on as to whether, like, the Indians on the Klamath or the Smith, either one, whichever one it was that they think might not have had them, whether they had a word for the coho. And there's a lot of very interesting discussions going on with the genetics, too. Anyway, the point is that the sockeye salmon who run up to someplace in Idaho are going to be pretty different than the sockeye who run up in Alaska. And yes, they are still the same species, but there are, I don't know the numbers, but there's a large percentage of runs of salmon. There's also, see, they can break down a lot of ways. So you got Chinook salmon, and you got Chinook salmon that run in the Sacramento River. You got them that run up the Elwha, and those would be, you could tell if you did genetic determination on them, you could tell which is which, and they probably would not. The ones from Elwha are probably not going to go up the Sacramento. I believe the numbers are about 3 to 4% of salmon go to the wrong river, which is pretty cool too, because that's how they re-inhabit once one gets wiped out. But they'll be different, and then not only that, but you'll have spring run, fall run, summer run, winter run, and those fish are different too. That the fish who are on winter run are not going to be the same fish who are on the summer run, and if you eliminate the winter run, then you've eliminated the winter run. It's not just that some fish will, eventually some fish would figure out that they could run up then, but all of those are, I believe, rightly measured separately.
I think it's been accepted in terms of numbers that the Pacific salmon population currently is 1% of the population that it once was. Despite 5 billion fish being released from hatcheries every year. And in game.
Is that counting those fish or not fish? Is that wild fish or all fish?
I think it is including them, but I don't know.
Wow, that's even worse then.
Yeah. But I could be wrong. So I don't want to stick to that.
Okay.
I might be wrong about that. But with that in mind, and in game, you wrote a compelling case that water is the foundation for a moral civilization, and 2/3 of the world's rivers are no longer free-flowing. Scientists are concerned that all marine life in the oceans at risk of extinction. And in our last interview, when I asked you about hope, you expressed your answer in part by saying that if the dams come down, you can only hope that the fish will return. And in Endgame, you also wrote that the most common words you ever hear spoken by environmentalists anywhere are, we're fucked. So my question is, do you have any additional comments?
There's something for which I have no patience whatsoever, which is the people who say, well, we're fucked, so let's just party, or let's just give up, or let's just take care of our own family, or let's just be a prepper. And the reason I don't have any patience for that is that we're talking about life on the planet, and we're talking, I mean, the stakes are so high that if there is a 1/1,000,000th of a 1% chance that any work we do will do any good whatsoever, then we have to do it. It's like a friend of mine says, John Osborne, as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is he's specifically talking about salmon and bull trout and others too, but it's like if the salmon are still alive on the Smith River in 10 years, they may still be alive in 100, but if they're gone in 10 years, that genetic line is gone. And so there's also, in our last interview, did we talk at all about Henning von Treskow?
I don't believe so.
Okay, so Henning von Treskow was a really interesting guy. He was a German general in World War II who was a part of the resistance against Hitler. And at one point, after D-Day, some members of the plotting against Hitler said, well, you know, the war is basically over because after now there's two fronts, and so we were doing bad enough in Russia, and now there's two fronts, it's just a matter of time. So why should we risk our lives to try to stop this when it's done anyway? And his response was, 11,000 civilians are dying every day. I think it was 11,000. Are dying every day. So every day that we can bring this war, every day sooner that we can bring this war to an end is 11,000 civilians who didn't die. And then also, we have to show to the world and to history that there were some in Germany who did not go along. And we have to show that there were a few good people here. And it's the same, that we have to act, even though we all know that this culture can't last. And there's a lot of people go, yeah, 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 it's all coming down on its own. Everything will be fine. But it's like, no, that's not true. The 200 species that went extinct today, it's not fine. The 200 species going extinct tomorrow, it's not fine. The day after that, it's not fine. And so there's two reasons that we must act. One of them is that, as he said, there's 11,000 civilians. In this case, there's 200 species every day. And so every day sooner that we can stop this madness is 200 more species. You know, you just mentioned a minute ago that there are scientists, and you got this from Endgame, but it's all over the news. There are a lot of stolid scientists who are saying that the oceans could be devoid of fish by 2050. And I think if this culture, if we look at the achievements of this culture, you know, putting a person on the moon, sending probes into outer space, you know, whatever miracles of modern medicine, I think if you looked at the most monumental achievement that this culture has achieved, the most stupendous achievement, the most, if you listed them for somebody 6,000 years ago, you said somebody 6,000 years ago, okay, they're going to put a person on the moon, they're going to, you know, do this, do that, do that. And if you put in that list that they were going to kill the oceans, they would say, that's the one I don't believe. Because, I mean, the oceans are so big. The oceans are, what, 3/4 of the planet? And mm-hmm. and they, I mean, all the accounts that what people need to do is read old accounts of what the world was like prior to what this culture has done, where there would be so many whales out in the ocean that the air would stink from their breathing, and it would look like it was foggy because of when they come up and blow, and all the spouts, and there were so many fish in the North Atlantic that they would literally slow down fish because or slow down ships because the ship's trying to go through the fish, and there's just so many that they slow it down. And there were so many fish in the Hudson River that when somebody threw a net in, it would carry your net away. It's just the richness was unimaginable, and we're blowing it. We're blowing it badly. I know this is a bit Christian, but I saw a cartoon that made me laugh several years ago, which was, you know, God had, like, was paying attention to other planets for a while, and then he comes back and he looks at Earth and humans like, you had one job, which is to not mess this up, and look what you did. Anyway, so I think the attitude when I talk about the thing about we're fucked, what I'm talking about is not in any way giving up, but instead, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've written an essay for a magazine editor, and the magazine editor has said, I want you to write about the apocalypse, and I say, okay, great, and then they say, I want you to make sure you have a happy ending. It's like, we spend so much energy trying to feel positive. But it's like a doctor friend of mine says that the first step toward proper treatment is correct diagnosis, the first step toward proper treatment. And, you know, I really take the medical model on this, is that if I have Crohn's disease, you know, you need to tell me so we can figure out what the next step is. I don't want you to pretend I don't have it and pretend things aren't as bad as they are. You know, when they told my mom she had cancer, she, you know, the doctor came in, my mom was lying in the bed after having had the thing, and he came in and he squatted down next to her bed and was holding her hand and said, I'm sorry, it's cancer. So now we have to, you know, now we do some more tests to figure out what the next steps are. And then when they told her it's not operable, I said, I'm sorry, it's not operable. So you need to, I mean, I'm sorry, and they said why, and we need to. This is one of the things that frustrates me about so much of the environmental movement, is that we keep considering losses to be near victories. It's like, no, just acknowledge what's going on, and then we move from there.
Well, I think that's great. I mean, and you also inadvertently answered, again, my first question was, you know, going back to the do humans have a purpose, and your quote about giving back. So I think,
well, I think specifically, I don't know what the role of humans would be in a healthy community. We can, you know, we can talk about some of the things that humans can do. You know, certainly we eat. We in this region here, we would eat salmon and we would poop them out just like bears. So we would be moving nutrients. But what I do know is that right now, right now, the humans who are living now, our responsibility is to protect wild nature from other humans. That's what we need to do. And a line I've said a bunch is, you know, if Delta smelt could take on human manifestation, what would they do? If coho salmon could take on human manifestation, what would they do? If prairie dogs could take on human manifestation, what would they do? And the reason I'm asking that is because we have taken on human manifestation, and we are nature. We, you, me, everybody listening to this, we are nature taking on human manifestation. And so it's not a theoretical question of if Delta smelt could take on human manifestation, what would they do? It's like, you are nature taking on human manifestation. What are you going to do? And at this point, it's pretty clear. We need to protect wild nature, and we need to stop this culture from killing wild nature. That's pretty clear. And then once we've done that, then the people who come after can, you know, we don't have to do everything. It's like, God, can nobody else do anything at all? We need to stop this, and then tomorrow somebody else can, you know, over the next several generations, people can figure out what their role is in that natural community where they live, which will be different than it was before because the salmon aren't here anymore. At least not in huge numbers. But the good thing about salmon is, like prairie dogs, if you just leave them alone, they'll come back pretty fast. There are some creatures have really slow reproductive rates, and they can be their re-inhabitation can be really problematical and scary. But the thing is, if we were to stop all this madness right now and we're able to stop global warming, etc., then salmon, I have no doubt, would be fine because they are so, you know, they have so many babies and then they are so good at re-inhabiting places. I don't think this is true forever, but I think if this continues on for another 5 or 10 years, I don't know that salmon will, I'll be able to say that salmon are going to be okay. But if humans all of a sudden either tomorrow disappeared or became nature loving instead of nature hating tomorrow, I think salmon would still be fine. Just like I think prairie dogs would be fine because they're both incredibly adaptable. Again, this is not true forever. This is not, and I think the time is very close when this won't be true. And I was talking to somebody just the other day about, I don't remember what species it was, but it was a species with a really low reproductive rate that, you know, basically even if humans stopped doing terrible things to them now, they would be really slow. But it's interesting too that, okay, so I know this is way off topic, but that's what you get with me, is I was talking to a grizzly bear expert many years ago about the difference between grizzly bear re-inhabitation and wolf re-inhabitation. But wolves are notorious for, or famous, I'll use a positive word, wolves are famous for, you have a wolf pack in Wyoming, and then what do you know? Suddenly, you've got a couple wolves down in southern Oregon and northern California. They're really known for traveling a long ways to find a new home. And so, I asked a grizzly bear person if grizzly bears do the same thing, and she said, "No, not at all. That basically, grizzly bears expand block by block. That you have a mother's territory, and the males don't really have. They have sort of meta territories, but they're not important for the moment." So you have a female, and then she has a baby, and then that daughter will still learn from the mother, and she will basically take up shop next door. So I don't know what their range is. Let's say their range is 50 square miles. I'm making that up.
I think it's one mile. I guess it depends on where you are. I used to live in Sitka, Alaska, where there's more bears than people, and I think there it's 1 mile.
Okay, well, so 1 square mile. We'll use that. So then the daughter's going to take up residence next door. And then her daughter, you know, 2 miles away, and her daughter 3 miles away. So it would take, I was asking her this in context of, grizzly bears re-inhabiting California on their own. And she was saying, no, it's not going to happen like it has with wolves, that this would take many, many, many years. If humans either exited the picture or became suddenly smart and nice tomorrow, it would still take grizzly bears on their own a long time to re-inhabit. And I guess the way this has to do with salmon is that salmon are the other type where salmon could bounce back. Okay, I'm just making this up, and I could be wrong, but you know, if humans either disappeared or became really nice tomorrow, I think within 100 years, and let's pretend all the dams disappeared too. Within 100 years, the 100 to 200 years, I think the salmon would have re-inhabited much of their territory again, presuming global warming hasn't, you know, kicked into high gear, et cetera.
Yeah, I recently learned that when Mount St. Helens exploded, it just, you know, completely destroyed the surrounding area, and people worried that the fish in the area were gone. And I believe there was a hatchery on the river near Mount St. Helens. I don't know what the river is. But within a couple of years, the salmon population was significantly higher than it was before the explosion. Because I think the hatchery was gone.
Yeah, there's that. And then there's also, when I was writing, this is kind of a funny story. When I was writing Endgame, there were a couple of hydrologists who were saying to me, gosh, you know, it's a terrible idea to tell people to take out dams, because if a dam blows up, it will be devastating to the salmon. And two stories along that. One of them is I was doing a call-in show in a radio show in Olympia, Washington, and I expressed that, you know, it's like, I don't know, is it better to take out a dam? And a couple people called up and they said, got two words for you, Missoula flood. And the Missoula flood, for those who know, it's an extraordinary thing. It was in the last ice age, there was a big lake formed in western Montana because there was a glacier blocked the flow of water. So basically, Flathead Lake or something, some lake up there, became absolutely immense. And then at some point, the lake got so big that it floated the glacier like an ice cube, and that caused the river to start rushing out, which caused the glacier to break up, and all the river ran down the Columbia Valley, or the whole Columbia Basin. And it was I think the number was 8 times as much water was flowing down the Columbia as the rest of the fresh water, as the rest of the rivers in the world combined, for however long it took. And I always get the numbers mixed up, whether it was 60 feet deep and 200 miles an hour or 200 feet deep and 60 miles an hour. But it was fast and deep. And it scoured out the whole Coulee area, and it backed all the way up the Willamette Valley. It's really extraordinary what it did. And the point is, the point that the guy was making was that salmon survived that, and they're not surviving now. But they survived. And not only was there was multiple Missoula floods. This happened over and over. So that was one story. And then the other story is kind of funny, that I wanted to really know if this is harmful. You know, if taking out a dam on its own without doing all the special preparations like they did at Elwha, if that's worse or better for a river. So I started calling up people. I'm such an idiot sometimes. I started calling up various fisheries biologists, and I said, hey, so if somebody blew up a dam, would that hurt or help the salmon? Click. And so then I got smart and realized that I was asking this in a way that, of course, they're not going to answer, because I was a nut job. So I called different ones, because I'd already blown my chance with those. I called different ones and said, so if, let's pretend it's 20 years from now, and the grid has collapsed, and the community is deciding whether or not to blow up a dam or to let it go, and to just eventually, you know, it's no longer useful economically, it's no longer useful for anything. Do you just take it out and, you know, of course, remove everybody from below hand first, all the humans, so that nobody gets hurt, and then do you blow it, and then, or do you just let it go, and then eventually it'll crumble on its own? And all the fisheries biologists I talked to were like, nah, take it out now. And they had these great conversations about that, that basically a dam failing is nothing but a big flood. And floods happen all the time, and dams happen all the time. The problem is not, in fact, dams at all, because you'll get log jams, you'll get landslides, you get lava flows. Rivers get dammed. It's just part of life. The problem is when all the rivers are dammed all the time. He was saying that the Mount Shasta, I think one of them was saying, Mount Shasta sent down a volcanic, you know, a lava flow, and that made a dam on the Shasta River, which lasted for however many years until finally it broke through. And so they said basically a dam failing is just a river, is just a big flood. That's all it is. And floods happen too all the time. And rivers survive them. And so then I talked to this one wonderful fisheries biologist up in the Olympic Peninsula, and she had this great line, which was, so she works with a free-flowing river that's not dammed at all, and she said that we constantly misdefine and misunderstand rivers, that a river is not water flowing down just a bank, I mean just a channel. Instead, rivers, what they do is they ride like snakes across the landscape, or they dance, they move. They're here, and then there's a big flood, and then they move over here, and then there's a big flood, and they move over there. And so she said it's not every time the river that she loves very much floods, it breaks her heart because it kills deer, it kills trees, it kills frogs, it kills fish, it kills insects. It's incredibly destructive, and it kills lots and lots of little beings and big beings. But at the same time, every time it floods, it makes her really happy because this is what the river does, and it's making new habitat. And she said this wonderful line that just slapped me in the face, which is, every time the river floods, it's short-term habitat loss and long-term habitat gain. And she was talking about the river, and that's true. That's very true. But I immediately also saw the sort of metaphorical implications of why do people stay in bad relationships? Why do people stay in jobs they don't like? Why do people not fight back against civilization? Why do people not bring civilization down? Short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. We are so often, myself included, so afraid of short-term habitat loss that we will put up with it for our entire lives rather than go through the short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. And so that's true physically. And it's also, it seems to me, really true metaphorically. I mean, it's a wonderful, this is one of the bazillion ways that nature can teach us how to live. You know, that's a lesson the river can give you is yeah, there's going to be short-term habitat loss, but long-term habitat gain. And don't be so afraid of it.
Okay, well, thank you so much for, again, taking the time to talk to me.
Borrowed Time is a collaborative effort by librarians to combat climate change by discussing sustainability issues and all things related to the human influence on our ecosystem. For more episodes, visit borrowed-time.org.